Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up today on the program, Greece and the Eurozone, yes, again. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. And farewell, Sky Mall, we hardly knew ya. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 23rd of January today. Good as always to have you with us. And let us dig right in, shall we? Find out what the heck happened this week in business and the economy, and more to the point, why it happened. For that, we've got Jolene Kent from Fox Business, also Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Hello, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
All right, Joe, happy Friday to you, too. Let me ask you first, Joe. The European Central Bank this week started what is known as quantitative easing. It has been, I think it's fair to say, a long time in coming. Why did it take the Europeans so long to do what the American Fed did 4 or 5 years ago?
Well, it sounds like they really got to a point where they had to do something, and they actually did more than what was generally expected, 60 billion euros a month starting in March, ending, you know, September 2016. But what's really interesting here to me is how this is going to affect the U.S. markets and what this is going to do to U.S. companies that really primarily face the Eurozone or face international markets. You know, it's not good necessarily for the euro and its value.
Right. Not good for the euro. The dollar is much stronger now, Cardiff, right? So exports, as we talked about a little bit yesterday, exports are going to be a little trickier.
Yeah. And by the way, it might be time to book that trip to Spain or France if you've been putting that off as well.
Are the mechanics of quantitative easing harder over there? I mean, he's got all those sovereign central banks to wrangle. Mario Draghi does.
They certainly are a little bit more complicated, and that's part of the reason I think they waited a while. Another part of the reason, by the way, to add to what Joe said, is that they had to wait for the banking system to become a little bit healthier to get fixed, because part of the way this is supposed to work is that it's supposed to incentivize the banks to lend more. They probably weren't going to do that until their balance sheets were in better shape. So, yeah, quantitative easing is a little bit more complicated over there, but I do think it's going to have some best beneficial effects. And they really did get to the point where economic growth was so weak and inflation was so low, and in fact it had tipped into deflation, that they really had to do this.
Mm-hmm. Joe, quickly on this and then we'll move on. Do you think it's going to take, like as it did here, 4 to 5 years to see any results over there?
Well, it sounds like they don't want it to. They're giving it, what, a year and a half to do it. But it is such a complicated situation. We'll talk about Greece later, but that definitely factors into it. And, of course, the Fed is watching this very closely as they go into that meeting next week.
Yeah, you saw my notes. Did you know we were going to Greece later? Is that what's going on?
I heard. I was craving Greek food.
So, Cardiff, we're going to have a piece from Stephen Beard in Athens in just a couple of minutes. But I want to ask you, in advance of that vote this weekend, do you believe this is necessarily the end of the Greek discussion about the Eurozone? I mean, it's deeply troubled over there. Are we done finally now?
You mean the beginning of the end, I guess, is what it would be. I mean, I feel like I hit my head and woke up in 2012 or something. It's unbelievable we're doing this again. Look, it's still the case that a Greece leaving the Eurozone is bad for Greece and bad for the rest of Europe. So my sense of it is that they're going to push hard to arrive at some kind of a compromise. But the problem is that the more often these things happen, the greater the chances that it's going to slip through at some point. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's worth being worried about for the next few months.
Joe, let me bring it back here for a minute. The State of the Union was Tuesday night. The president spent plus or minus two-thirds of an hour or so long speech on the economy. It was, I think you can fairly call it a victory lap, right? Taking credit for the economy. Does he deserve the credit for where the economy is today?
Well, the job numbers are really strong, but we have to remember that wage growth just isn't there yet. And so, you know, the president has a lot certainly to be, you know, given his economic policies, there is a lot there to be proud of, I suppose. But there certainly is for the average American. There actually hasn't been that much of a dent in their paycheck. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I'm really looking forward going forward is, are we going to see any wage growth? What does that mean for spending? Of course, gas prices now helping out the cause. Mm-hmm. In a major way over the holiday season and going forward.
Cardiff, deserved or not deserved victory lap?
Only deserves a little bit of credit. Hmm. The Fed deserves some credit. And also remember that the U.S. economy has always been more powerfully cyclical than other advanced economies. So this was a combination of things. He can take credit for, I guess, not screwing it up worse than it already was. And that's, by the way, that's not nothing. Yeah. But I don't think he deserves like a huge amount of credit for the economy getting back to where it is now.
Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. Wall Street today, well, you know, it was meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. UPS, United Parcel Service, of course, did something called an earnings pre-announcement this morning, bracing the market, you might say, for the official bad news yet to come. UPS says it invested a whole lot of money to make sure everything ran smoothly during the holidays last year. Too much money, it turns out. Profits were thus down, as was its stock price today, almost 10% in the red. Dan Bobkoff explains why good service ended up being bad for UPS's bottom line.
Before we talk about what happened last month, we have to go back to 2013.
Things were pretty bad, and there were multiple reasons for it.
Satish Jindal heads ShipMatrix, which tracks shipping performance. In 2013, bad information and bad weather led UPS to deliver lots of last-minute presents after Christmas. So in 2014,
UPS started to realize that they needed to have a much better service than what they did in 2013.
Call it overcompensating. It hired thousands more seasonal workers and invested in trucks and equipment. That's expensive. Nate Brockman is an analyst at William Blair.
They really did deliver outstanding service and did not have any failures. But the problem was they received a lot of volume on just a handful of peak days throughout the month of December.
In effect, UPS had enough staff and resources as if every day was going to be an extravaganza. UPS's chief financial officer, Kirk Kuhn, put it this way in an audio statement.
Obviously, we overswung on cost.
E-commerce is growing and changing so fast that it's hard to predict demand. UPS has to adjust because more of its business these days is delivering single packages to homes rather than unloading a bunch of boxes at offices. It says it will control costs next Christmas. The question is, can it do that and still get us our presents on time? In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Better, that's all I'm saying, presents on time. The first big tech IPO of the year happened today. BOX is the ticker symbol. It's also handily the name of the company, as in a box up in the cloud that stores companies' data. Today's initial public offering pretty much blew the lid off the company's shares. Sorry about that. Up 66% at the close. Obviously, a day to remember for those involved. But the thing is, this was a day that was originally supposed to happen last spring. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains why a company might wait on the market.
An IPO is kind of like a first date between a company and stock market investors. Naturally, the company wants to make the best impression possible. And so, a rain check?
It's fairly unusual.
Jay Ritter is a professor of finance at the University of Florida.
It's a little embarrassing to postpone the deal.
Ritter says a company might commit this corporate faux pas because it's gotten the sense that investors are just not that into it.
And most of the time, investors are right.
In Box's case, investors were worried it was spending too much on marketing, not to mention the corporate cloud storage business is extremely competitive and pits Box against giants like Microsoft and Google. Rob Koplowitz is an analyst at Forrester.
You can take your files out of one system and bring them into another that's lower priced.
Koplowitz says the last year gave Box time to change investors' minds and convince them it doesn't just store documents, it helps users collaborate. A better business.
But also, you know, a big part of it was the timing.
Paul Bard, research director at Renaissance Capital, says just before the planned Box IPO last year, the market turned for companies like Box, and prices were starting to drop.
Valuations were contracting. There was a big uptick in volatility in the broader market, and that scared a lot of investors, quite honestly.
Since then, the market has turned around, and Box has been able to point at some successes, like signing up GE as a customer. But Forrester's Koplowitz points out that it is still spending too much and making too little.
What they really want to do is they want to land more GEs, don't we all?
In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
This has been, as Joe Cardiff and I were talking about up at the top of the program, and next week will be big over in Europe. Greeks vote on Sunday in an election that has fairly been called crucial. The far-left Syriza party, which is ahead in the polls, I should tell you, has promised to reverse some of that country's big budget cuts and to renegotiate the terms of its bailout from the European Union and the IMF. The outgoing government says that would inevitably force Greece out of the eurozone, the European single currency, which would be overwhelmingly unpopular in Greece, leaving the euro. But after all the heartbreak of euro membership, and there has been plenty, why are the Greeks so eager to stay? Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Athens.
In his last speech of the campaign, Syriza's youthful leader fired up his supporters. He urged them to raise their fists, end this national humiliation, and stop taking orders from abroad. But this is a country that's utterly dependent on the kindness of foreign creditors. What is going on in Greece? Let's start on the psychiatrist's couch.
Being a psychiatrist, I'm able, I think, to see through people, at least in Athens, where I live.
Dr. Dimitrios Papadimitriadis. His practice is booming in these anxious times. He says the Greeks feel angry and hurt that their wealthier European neighbours haven't shouldered more of Greece's national debt.
Being part of a European family means taking care of each other. And this is what family is all about.
But members of this family, the Eurozone, don't speak the same language. When the Greek Prime Minister went to Berlin and asked for debt relief, the German leader, Angela Merkel, asked for the phrase to be translated. When it was, she said, it doesn't sound so good in German. Nevertheless, the Greeks still seem to love the euro.
Greek citizens realise that the only future lies within the eurozone.
Konstantin Michalos, head of the Greek Chamber of Commerce.
The last poll showed that 92% of the Greek citizens show that they're in favour of the eurozone and the euro.
The mystery of this attachment deepens when you consider the figures. Under the straitjacket of EU IMF austerity, the Greek economy has shrunk by a quarter. Unemployment has soared to 27%. 10% of Athenians depend for their food on charities. At the SOS Social Centre, they're tuning up an old piano. The centre provides education, daycare, food and other help for poor families. Down in the basement, Spiros, a 55-year-old unemployed insurance worker, and his wife are rummaging through huge piles of donated second-hand clothing. They found a Batman outfit for their 7-year-old son. Spiros has had a desperate 3 years since he lost his job, but he doesn't for a minute blame the euro. No, he says, it's not the euro's fault, it's the fault of our politicians. The Greeks trust European officials far more than their own public servants. The Greeks seem torn between the hope that Syriza will persuade the Germans to loosen the austerity and lighten the debt load, and the fear of ejection from the eurozone and all the turmoil that would entail. Former government minister Adnis Georgiadis says that would be like trying to change airlines in mid-flight.
You enter the plane and the plane is on the air, you cannot change your mind. If you open the door and you say, I want to go to the other airline, you will be destroyed. This is the euro. We entered, we stay.
That's one kind of bailout the Greeks are eager to avoid. But if Syriza gets its hands on the controls after Sunday's election, it could be a bumpy ride. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up...
Well, it's my favorite part of flying.
The in-flight staple that is no more. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 0.75% today, 141 points, 17,672 for the blue chips. The S&P 500 gave back 0.5%, 11 points, finished at 2,051. But the NASDAQ picked up 0.1%, that is 7 points, ended the week at 4,757. Speaking of the week, it was the best one of the year so far. The Dow up 0.9%, the NASDAQ charged ahead 2.7%, the S&P 500 climbed 1.6%. As we mentioned, Box had a very big day, but other players in the cloud also rose. Google clicked up 1%. Amazon advanced 0.2%. Apple took home about 0.5% extra. McDonald's got grilled again after releasing another poor quarterly report. Shares down nearly 1.5%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Microsoft releases quarterly earnings. Grab your Stetson. The National Cowboy Poetry Gathering gets underway in Elko, Nevada. And in other parts of the country, people observe Bubble Wrap Appreciation Day, devoting time to packing or popping, or writing some cowboy bubble wrap verse. Who knows? Bubbles may want to break away from the pack and float off to the Wild West. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury, said in a speech earlier this week that, yeah, Democrats and Republicans in Congress do have differences on tax policy, specifically individual taxes, but that there still might be a way to get business tax reform done this year. Whatever winds up happening, you can bet there will be a lobbyist pushing for it or against it. Kelsey Snell has a piece in Politico. It's called Tax Reform Dead? Don't tell the lobbyists. Kelsey, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tax lobbying is a big business, you write. It's bigger even than healthcare lobbying last year?
Yeah, it's actually been bigger than healthcare lobbying for a few years now. It's been growing and growing, and healthcare lobbying has been falling.
What they are trying to do is get ahead of what could conceivably be a moving train, but in reality will be a train that is stuck at the station, right?
Well, tax reform is always a slow-moving train until it's almost done, and then it explodes out
right.
the gate. We're kind of at the stage right now where nobody knows how quickly it might be moving because we don't really know how all the players want to approach it.
Give us a sense of how big a business it is. You write that 2,000 clients retained lobbyists last year. That's a pretty good number of people.
Yeah, it's actually just shy of 2,000. And, you know, that's companies, that's cities. It's a whole wide range of people who want to make sure that they get heard on Capitol Hill. And we're talking about anywhere from $100,000 a quarter down to, you know, maybe $500 a quarter. I mean, that would be some pretty small bore lobbying, but it can get pretty big.
There's a personnel game going on here as well. And you break out Orrin Hatch, who chairs the relevant Senate committee and is a senior senator, has been there for a while in and on that committee. And then Paul Ryan, who now is the brand new chairman of Ways and Means. And people are trying to figure out basically how to get in front of him.
Yeah, you know, tax lobbyists probably had some relationship with Paul Ryan before now, but they have to approach him in a little bit different way than when he was budget committee chairman. He now controls kind of the levers for big issues like Social Security, taxes, and health care. And he runs kind of a closed circle here in Washington. And people have to really figure out what the best way is to get him to listen to their needs specifically.
It's been 25 years since we've had tax reform. Is it any wonder that people are all of a sudden getting nervous because it's been, you know, pent up demand, right?
Yeah, it's been pent up demand. And the conversation has really heated up over the past couple of years. Last year, well, actually in 2013, you saw the Finance Committee chairman at the time, who was Max Baucus, and the tax writer in the House, Dave Camp, were really working together and they were drumming up all the support. They even went on a nationwide tour of togetherness on tax reform. And that's when companies started to really pay attention. It didn't seem like they were necessarily going to get a bill right away, but that conversation made people perk up and start their lobbying gears going.
There is a long game being played here, and you point this out, right? I mean, these companies are spending $100,000 a quarter, just for instance, now to avoid perhaps having tax implications 20 years down the line.
Yeah, it's kind of a game of chess here. You're deciding if you want to invest up front. It's like buying insurance almost. Say you come out in a bad way in this tax reform. Say you wind up having to pay a couple percent more this year. It's not just this year. It's until they decide to rewrite the tax code again. And there's really no certainty as to when that might be.
Kelsey Snell, she covers tax policy for Politico. Kelsey, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
This is going to sound a little, I don't know, down in the weeds as a way to set up a tech story. But the fact is, most of us are really attached to our search engines. Googlers like Google, Bingers like Bing, you get the idea. That wouldn't really matter so much were there not so much money involved. Google is the default search engine for Apple's Safari browser, which means that when you use Safari on your phone or on your computer and you search for something, you wind up at Google automatically. But back to that so much money thing, you better believe there is some competition growing in that space. Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
If you use Safari, you don't have to use Google, but Stan Leibowitz, an economist at the University of Texas, Dallas, says search engines bet most users won't change a browser's settings.
There certainly is a fair amount of people who just go with the default.
This relationship started when Apple introduced the iPhone, and since then, Yahoo has been trying to break it up. So has Microsoft.
Oh, I think they would certainly like to be the second wife. We'll just call it that.
Analyst Kim Forrest is with the Fort Pitt Capital Group, and she says the marriage has been mutually beneficial. Apple hasn't had to create its own search engine, and what Google is paying for are millions of Apple users' eyeballs.
Search is a huge money-making business. You can print money if you can do it correctly, and we know Google does that.
96% of what Google makes comes from search. It's a $54 billion business. Now, this browser search engine wedding may have made more sense when it happened back in 2007 when Apple and Google were not really rivals. But Danny Sullivan, who runs a site called Search Engine Land, says the marriage became awkward and acrimonious, and Apple may want out.
They just don't really, I think, want to partner with a competitor like Google if they can help it. It'd be easier to partner with somebody else that doesn't have a strong challenge with them in the tablet and the phone space.
And we've already seen Apple make moves. Last June, the company switched the default browser its digital assistant uses from Google to Microsoft Bing.
They made this shift in Siri, and really nobody screamed that, wow, I don't get my Google results anymore. I'm getting Bing results.
Apple didn't want to comment, and Google didn't get back to us. So why are Yahoo and Microsoft and maybe a few smaller search engines coveting their neighbor's deal? Anindo Ghosh teaches IT and marketing at NYU, and he's done work with tech companies, including Apple and Google.
More than 53% of search is coming from smartphones, and a big part of the smartphone market is owned by Apple, right?
The terms of Apple's deal with Google are not public, but analyst Richard Kramer with Arete Research says Google has a similar deal with AOL.
They get paid about $100 million a quarter to send traffic Google's way.
Kramer, by the way, owns stock in Yahoo. Yahoo recently displaced Google as the default search engine in the U.S. version of Mozilla's Firefox browser. And entrepreneur John Battelle, who wrote a book called The Search, wonders how many Firefox users missed Google so much they switched back.
I'm sure Mozilla knows that down to the fraction of a decimal point, but unfortunately we don't.
And the change rate in Safari is something search engines will consider carefully when this Apple deal comes up for renewal. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
I have some really, really bad news for those of you who enjoy the occasional flip through the SkyMall catalog as you settle in for your flights. With shrinking sales and the rising use of electronics on board, the company that owns the, I think it's safe to say, one-of-a-kind catalog company has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. In a statement, the acting CEO said he is holding out hope for a buyer and that the business is set to be auctioned off in March. But Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports finding a bidder may be tough.
33-year-old construction executive Nathan Gass doesn't usually fly, but when he does, he reads SkyMall.
Well, it's my favorite part of flying. You know, you got to check out what the new things are, the most obscure Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings related memorabilia you can find.
SkyMall's a cult-like status thanks to some of the straight-up wacky stuff they sell. Raise your hand if you've ever considered buying the life-size Bigfoot Garden Yeti for about $2,200, or the Star of David Christmas tree ornament, a must-have, the catalog tells us, for every interfaith couple. But over the past few years, Forrester research analyst Sucharita Mulpuru says fewer and fewer of us are doing our freaky-deaky shopping at 36,000 feet.
Back in like 2009, the revenues were like $80 million. You flash forward to like 2013, and the number is $30 million.
What's killing SkyMall? One, airlines are dropping the catalog. And two, the company blames us and our phones and tablets.
Virtually everybody has devices that kind of have better content that can occupy you.
Despite its struggles, the company still generated more than $15 million in sales through the third quarter last year. That's because of people like Nathan Gass, who loved the battery organizer he got from SkyMall so much, he bought a second one.
I bought it for my father-in-law for Christmas. He loves that kind of thing. And I was so proud of mine that, you know, he would have stolen it if I hadn't bought him one, probably.
Seems like whether SkyMall survives or not, there's always going to be a market for stuff you never knew you wanted. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which maybe we can settle once and for all the whole "can money buy you happiness" conundrum. The answer, according to a study in the journal Social Psychology and Personality Science, is that once you do the regression analysis and adjust for all the other factors, having more money does indeed reduce unhappiness, but does not increase happiness. Seems it all revolves around something social scientists call negativity bias, that we, being humans after all, are more affected by bad things than good things. So there you go. Now you know. All right, on a Friday, we are done. The Dow off 0.75% today, 141 points. The Nasdaq up 0.1%, 7 points. The S&P 500 went the other way, gave back 0.5%, 11 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The producer of this program is Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.